Welcome to Mast Cell Matters, deep dives on mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, with Dr. Tanya Dempsey. This is a monthly feature of the POTSCast, the weekly nonprofit podcast of Standing Up to POTS. If you would like to hear all of our great episodes about POTS and related medical conditions, please consider subscribing. Now, please enjoy this episode of Mast Cell Matters.
Hello, fellow mast cell patients and lovely people who care about mast cell patients. I'm Jill Brooke, and this is Mast Cell Matters, where we go deep on all things related to mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, with the help of our wonderful guest host, Dr. Tanya Dempsey, Johns Hopkins Med School graduate, world-renowned mast cell expert, physician, researcher, who is so kind to donate her time to be here today. Dr. Dempsey, thank you. And which of your brilliant colleagues did you bring with you today?
Well, I'm thrilled to have Dr. Casey Kelly here today. Dr. Kelly has devoted her career to helping people reclaim their health by uncovering the why behind chronic illness. As a board-certified physician in family medicine and one of the first physicians board-certified in integrative medicine, she's passionate about getting to the root cause of disease and empowering patients to achieve lasting wellness. Dr. Kelly is the founder and medical director of Case Integrative Health in Chicago, where she and her team take a science-driven, deeply personalized approach to care, combining the best of conventional medicine with the innovation of functional and integrative therapies to restore vitality and longevity. And internationally recognized expert in complex conditions like Lyme disease, Dr. Kelly is also a faculty member at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, where she teaches the next generation of physicians how to think differently about health and healing. A graduate of the Ohio State University College of Medicine, Dr. Kelly has been a member of the Institute for Functional Medicine for over 15 years and previously served as the treasurer of ILADS and is the first class of ILADS fellows. She's a frequent international speaker known for translating complex science into practical, compassionate care that inspires both clinicians and patients. Welcome, Dr. Kelly.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We always have fun. We, of course, know each other from various circles, including ILADS. And so I was really excited to have you here to talk about things that you're passionate about, including pediatric Lyme disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your journey into this realm. Maybe we can start there and hear how you got to this point in your career.
For sure. Yeah. Mine is a pretty personal story, and it's not all that different from most of the patient stories that we hear. I had chronic fatigue and was diagnosed with POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, when I was in medical school. And in medical school, I was really disheartened with, you know, the way we were just kind of taught to diagnose and give a treatment and then not really finding why and then giving another medicine for the side effects of that treatment. And just, you know, all of this just kind of felt wrong, right? It was like, we're missing something here. So I started to really get into integrative medicine and the American Holistic Medical Association, as it was back then, back in the day, and found people who are curious and interested, and found my people, right? These are doctors who are thinking through this and thinking through problems in a different way. And throughout that journey, I myself got diagnosed with Lyme, Bart, Babesia, the works. And when I was able to actually heal my adrenals, heal my gut, all of those things, all of my POTS went away. But in that process, I then started to look for it in my patients. And when you start looking for it, you start finding it. And then, you know, when you're treating Lyme, I kind of describe Lyme and other vector-borne infections as a masterclass in functional medicine, because you can't, it's not just a simple, here's your antibiotic and you're done. You really have to understand the whole body and how it works and how it works together and the complexities, because it presents so differently in everybody. And then that leads you to mast cell dysfunction and mold toxicity and autoimmune diseases and all these, you know, other layers that get piled upon these vector-borne infections. And so I've just really kind of honed in my practice and caring for these patients and trying to help, you know, get to the root cause of all these complex chronic illnesses.
Yeah. That's an amazing journey, and one that, you know, I think is actually quite common, unfortunately, where, you know, physicians either have issues themselves or their family members, and you learn through that process, and then you can't unsee what you, you know, what you see, what yeah. you know. So, yeah. So, but you do, you're board certified in is it family medicine,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
So you do see patients of all ages?
Correct.
And so tell us a little bit about, because I mean, my focus is mostly adults. I do some adolescent medicine, but because you're seeing the little ones, tell us a little bit about how they're presenting, what age range, you know, you're starting to see more and more, and what are the complex illnesses that are accompanying Lyme and some of the other things you're finding in them?
Yeah, you know, Lyme is actually very prevalent in kids. It's kind of scary. There's some of the statistics will say something like 205 kids a day are diagnosed with vector-borne infection, which is wild. Mm-hmm. Wild. That's, you know, more than diabetes, cancer, you know, all these things combined. It's a lot of kids, and they aren't usually going to present the same kind of textbook way that Lyme disease presents in an adult with, you know, a bullseye rash or a swollen knee. Although I have seen that. I have seen kids with a swollen knee. I've seen kids with Bell's palsy. I've seen kids with bullseye rashes. But a lot of these kids are actually going to present more with behavioral changes mm-hmm. or fatigue or abdominal pain, something that you don't necessarily immediately think of a tick-borne infection with these symptoms that arise. So you have to definitely be thinking about it and mm-hmm. questioning, and especially if they go through the rigmarole and everything's normal, right, through the normal pediatrician, being able to kind of look for these different issues that might be causing their symptoms.
Right, right. But it's harder in kids for reasons, right?
It can be. You know, I think that kids are resilient, so often I will see them heal faster if we can get, you know, the right point faster. Just, you know, they have, you know, 20, 40 less years of baggage on top of all of this. But they don't have the words, you know, they don't have the vocabulary. They can't explain what's going on. So a lot of it does get filtered through their parents, because their parents are seeing a change and their parents are noticing a difference. And the kids, you know, sometimes some of the behavioral changes too, it's they can't voice that their head hurts. They can't voice that their stomach hurts or they feel twitchy or itchy or something. You know, they just kind of lash out because they don't know how to do that yet, right? So it can be very tricky to get to that diagnosis, especially because the labs we have are not black and white. And we have to rely on those labs sometimes a lot harder with kids because they don't have that same history that you might find in a, you know, a more vocal adult. So it can be tricky. Absolutely.
Right, exactly. Can we talk a little bit about PANS and PANDAS in this population? Because I'm sure you see a lot of it. And we've brought it up, you know, a few times on this podcast, but I think it really deserves a little more attention. So I'm assuming that in some of these patients, one of the ways they're presenting is with inflammation in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your approach, what you notice, what the parents notice.
Yes. So PANDAS is traditionally associated with strep infection. So it's a pediatric autoimmune neuroencephalitis that happens after a strep infection. And it can be rather acute, and it's generally pretty abrupt. Kid is normal one day, the next day, all of a sudden they have severe anxiety, separation anxiety, OCD tendencies, big behavioral changes that are night and day. You know, the kid was fine and then they weren't. Kind of picture that we see with this. And it's very well documented with strep. And, you know, when kids come in with those type of symptoms, we are always looking for strep. We always have to look for strep markers, strep carrier strains, even strep swabs sometimes to see if we can kind of get to that.
Yeah.
But PANS is, you know, able to take that same symptoms and that same symptom cluster, but related to other infections. So it doesn't have to be strep. It could be Lyme or Bartonella or perhaps even a viral infection that can cause this. And again, it's an acute change. It is more of a night and day type of change that will happen in these kids. And it can be dramatic and it can be severe. These kids can be violent. They can hurt themselves or other people. They can just refuse to go to school. It's life-altering, these changes that happen in these kiddos. So we're always doing a good history. Is there exposure potentially to strep, but also tick-borne infections? You know, do you have a pet? Does the pet sleep in your bed? You know, do you play outside? It doesn't have to be someone who's, you know, hiking in the woods all day, every day who gets ticks or tick bites. Most people don't see or remember a tick bite. you know, kids are closer to the ground where the ticks live. They're playing around in that ground, and these ticks don't hurt. They don't itch. You don't notice that you have a tick bite if you're not looking for it. And most people don't get a rash, or if you do, perhaps it's on your scalp where you would never see it, right? So it's really easy to miss that in a kid, but we just know that all of a sudden there's a big difference. And so, you know, most people will go to their pediatrician, right? Something's changed. Something's up with my kid. And the pediatrician will do their normal testing and everything is quote unquote normal. So they get referred to psych and then they get put on psych meds, which can help, but they don't often and or always. And sometimes they actually make it worse and they're not actually looking for the root cause. So that's where we come in and look for those root causes and try to find those infections and treat what we find to see if we can affect a better, you know, improvement in symptoms and get rid of those behavioral changes.
How often do you see an underlying a mast cell or mast cell activation syndrome process along with the PANS and PANDAS?
Yeah, it's actually pretty common. I noticed it especially with Babesia infections. I think Bart and Lyme are close behind.
Yeah.
You may have, you know, better mental prowess around this for me, but it's always kind of like, what's the chicken and what's the egg? Did these kids already have some mast cell dysfunction? Because some of them are, you know, allergenic kids that kind of come in, but not always. And, you know, these, especially for me clinically, where I will see it is the Babesia. The Babesia just really wrecks those mast cells and those eosinophils, you know, they're associated with allergies and parasites, you know, they go hand in hand. And so those kids especially, and sometimes it's motion sickness or abdominal pain or nausea. That's kind of their big symptoms. They're not having the sneezing, the itching, you know, the flushing or anxiety too. Those mood changes that happen with the mast cells.
Or even POTS, you know, we've seen this in adolescents, but I'm sure you're seeing it in younger kids where, again, they can't explain it like POTS, but they don't feel well, like getting, like moving around. They want to be lying down more, right? So is it fatigue or is it an intolerance to position because of their heart rate and circulation? And I do agree that I think Babesia is a big driver of that, in my opinion, although they're all kind of in the mix. But I think the mast cells, I mean, I'll add my two cents, because I think the vast majority of patients who wind up with chronic infections and chronic conditions like PANS and PANDAS, even though it's an acute process, I see it as a chronic problem. The vast majority of them have some underlying vulnerability, whether it was apparent right from the start of their life or whether it became more apparent when they were infected. Often when you take the history and you go back to the health of the mother during pregnancy, when you start to understand what other family members feel or have, or you start to see a trend that a lot of these people, there are other family members with symptoms suggestive of MCAS, because I think there is something about MCAS that is making kids, adults, et cetera, more vulnerable to persistent infection. That's one key to the, I think there's more, I mean, it's not the only thing, but that's what I wonder about.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just kind of puts gasoline on that fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your approach? How do you start digging at the root cause and unraveling things, you know, because again, kids are a little bit maybe more sensitive, or you can't use the same doses of things that you do with adults. So where do you typically start? Understanding that everyone is different.
Sure. Yeah. And I try to be very picky with my blood work and testing on kids too. I mean, I am with adults as well, but I have a little more freedom, I think, to check under different rocks. With the little kiddos, I'm not trying to draw 20 tubes of blood. So I try to be very, very, very picky about it. But, you know, we test what we need to test. And if we have to do out-of-pocket tests or things to look for these infections, we got to look for it. We got to do it. We got to spend this money to try to figure out what is there. But it always starts with a really good history, really trying to dig in when it started, what the symptoms are like, you know, and digging into sleep and energy and gut, all of the things, right? We're kind of looking at that entire picture of this and the history back to, you know, were they a C-section kid? Were they breastfed or not? You know, that information is very useful to kind of get us in there and try to figure it out. But I use those labs to drive it, but I also use the history and the symptoms. And so at the end of the day, if I have a really strong suspicion that there's something going on, I'm going to tell the parents, I think this is what it is. Let's work together. Let's try these different treatments to treat it. And for me, it's a juggling act. There's always a bunch of plates spinning. It's about trying to fight whatever infections we find, whether that's an antibiotic or an herb. I do love herbs in kids. I think they tolerate them very well. I think they're easier on the gut. And, you know, I'm trying to be a good steward of antibiotics in that sense, too. But we will use antibiotics if we need to. But then we're also supporting the system. So we have to protect the gut when we're giving antibiotics or antibiotic herbs. We have to support the mast cells and the immune system and the Herxheimer detox, you know, or toxic reactions that can happen with these kids. And that's a lot of detox support and a lot of anti-inflammatories. And with kids, you know, we try to do as much with liquids and drops. You know, most of these kids can't take pills. Right. So we're also, you know, have to be mindful of that and trying to combine things or get them to taste decent enough so that they'll take them. Yeah. Right. So that's a challenge with kids too. And especially some of these kids are really, really picky. There's texture issues, there's sensitivity issues. They won't take this powder, they'll take that powder, they won't do this liquid, you know. So sometimes it's a little trial and error to get down to the treatment plan that works. But we try a lot of different things with kids, and it's about building and it's about supporting. So I'm always trying to support, not just attack. So it's not just attack mode. And sometimes we don't even start with attack mode, because if the kiddo doesn't feel like there's resilience enough, you know, maybe their gut is just too much of a mess or their mast cells are just out of control. You know, sometimes we have to spend some time to calm that inflammation and those symptoms down before we can even try to attack an infection. So it's very unique. It's very individualized. We kind of go patient by patient, but we're always trying to find the next rock. What's the next thing we're looking for? What's the next step in here to help you heal?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you have to do that with all these patients, right? I mean, whether they're young or older, I mean, you always have to keep moving things along. And sometimes you do have to redirect, right? You think you're going down one path and then you realize you have to switch gears, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you're really excited about right now? Either something that you're noticing more that you didn't notice before that people are not talking about, or a treatment or something. Where are you right now with the sort of cutting edge stuff? Let's talk about that.
So I would say there's a couple of things. So one is I'm really getting more and more excited about SOT, even in kids. Yeah. We have seen some really good results with SOT, especially when we can't tolerate antibiotics or herbs for one reason or another. It's a really great tool to help kids and adults for that matter as well. I know you use SOT as well.
We do a lot. And for the very sensitive patient, I mean, I think it's good for a lot of patients, right? But for the sensitive patient where you're really having trouble with the herbs, you're having trouble with antibiotics, you're having trouble with, especially if they're mast cell patients. Yeah, I think SOT has been really incredible. So I'm with
you. Yeah, it's been a great tool to have. And I think, you know, we were talking at our clinic, we have rounds every morning. So all of the providers come together and we talk on rounds. And one of the things that we're talking about today, I keep bringing up actually, I've just noticed more and more since COVID, the stickiness and the hypercoagulability in the endothelial dysfunction. Rampant and widespread. And these infections make it worse.
Yeah.
BBC is horrible. With biofilm and nests, Bartonella endothelial dysfunction and biofilm, Lyme, you know, the Borrelia miyamotoi's of the world, these big biofilm producers are just making it worse. And I'm seeing a lot of sticky blood issues, which is causing a lot of symptoms in kids too, not just adults.
Yeah.
Which affects our ability to oxygenate our tissues, which means our mitochondria don't work as well, which means our nervous system and our nerves aren't functioning properly. And it's just exacerbating everything.
We know that this was a problem for sure with patients who've had these infections. We saw this before COVID. COVID is like the magnifier to the nth degree.
Yeah.
So it just sort of like, it sets the stage. And even in people who had mild illness,
mm-hmm.
even in people who don't even know that they had COVID, a lot of them still have mm-hmm. the ramifications of it. And then it just compounds the problem, right?
Yeah. And we notice, I don't know if you notice, but the amount of heparin we've had to give before and after, we need more.
More. And you can see, like we do 10 pass ozone as well. And the blood comes up into the bottle. We ozonate it. There's heparin in there, of course. Mm-hmm. And then the heparin goes in with the blood. You could do this up to 10 times. And you can see the biofilm on the bottle when you do this. And you can see the people whose blood is like darker. It's darker and it's like this biofilm thing.
Yeah.
Those are the patients. It clots all the time. So we have to give more heparin. We have to change mm-hmm. treating. The blood is so hypercoagulable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a step change in the last 5 years. It's wild. And so we've been doing more and more and more testing and more treatment for these.
So what are you doing?
So what we're looking at are a couple markers, really trying to figure out if they're sticky because they're not clearing the fibrin clots or they're sticky because they're making too much fibrin. So if they're making too much fibrin, then, you know, I've even started to kind of dive into low doses of Eliquis, which is a medicine to help thin that blood. And then if they're not clearing the fibrin clots, that's where I really love the enzymes, the lumbar kinase, neprenol of the world, to eat up those fibrin clots. I call them Pac-Men, kind of eat up those clots. So I really love those to support. Those are great for biofilm too. You know, you have to be a little careful. At least I have noticed sometimes if you do that without having antimicrobials on board, you have released the Kraken. And that will exacerbate it.
Yeah, you can't start treating biofilms without like being prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For what's going to happen.
Exactly. And I mean, I use Arteriosil to help boost the glycocalyx inside the arteries, nitric oxide if we need to boost that. Even can use things like pentoxyphylline, which is an old school claudication medication. So, you know, we play around with what makes sense for the patient to help support that.
Yeah, I know. And there's a really great drug that is only available in Europe. And in particular, it's made in Italy. And it's very hard to get. I have had some patients who have been able to source it. I don't ask questions, but I will tell you that if you read the research on this, it's called sulodexide. It's very, very exciting research. Mm-hmm. And I wish we had the ability to use it here and had access to it, because I think that, you know, for patients, unfortunately, I don't know what it is about Eliquis, but a lot of my patients can't tolerate it.
Yeah.
And so if they need something, yes, sometimes using enzymes, but it's for these, some of these patients, not enough, right? So this is a tool that if you read the literature, I mean, it's been studied extensively in Europe.
Yeah, there's some COVID clinics in the States that are using it too. I don't know how they get it.
I know how they're getting it. They have a patient who goes to Italy and brings back cases. I'm telling you, like, I've heard some stories. There's got to be a better way, right?
Right.
We have mm-hmm. access to it. But anyway, I'm excited about that, but I just wish mm-hmm. you know, we could do something.
Yeah. I do think ozone is a great tool for these too. I mean, you know, minus the, you know, the extra heparin that we have to give, but I use it in kids too, not too young, maybe like 10 or 11 is kind of the youngest where we've added that. They respond really, really well to it. And, you know, we tend to start really low with the kids as far as the doses and go up and, you know, all of that. But yeah, it's another useful tool. It is an adult treatment, but we have great responses to the kids for this too. And I think ozone also helps with blood flow. It helps heal those blood vessels. It helps to heal and repair along with fighting the infection. So it makes sense, but it is a tool that we have used in kids.
I mean, listen, what I tell patients is that it's like super oxygen. Right? It's like instead of O2, it's O3. So imagine oxygenating your tissues. If you're not getting enough, now you're getting extra. So yeah, some patients react. Some patients, it's too much. You have to really kind of, it's always personalized, right? Mm-hmm. Always try to figure out dosing. But I've seen it help definitely in the vector-borne infection realm, long COVID, and even mold and mycotoxin mm-hmm. illness, where you're trying to like, you know, they're on binders or they're doing stuff and they, you're still not moving the needle. Mm-hmm. Sometimes ozone just does the trick.
Yeah.
And POTS. Yeah. I've seen POTS that symptom specifically. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's probably all these other things getting better. But I have a few patients with POTS is their main symptom, mm-hmm. and that gets better with those.
I know it helped me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've been playing around too. And so typically it's not unheard of for us to give a Myers cocktail and glutathione after ozone. But for these mast cell patients, I've been playing around with just a more simplified mast cell IV. So it's just vitamin C, magnesium, and taurine. Simpler. And that has helped amazing. That little IV combo has kind of turned around some anaphylactic reactions too in that mast cell cascade. I love that combo.
And you give that right after the ozone?
We do.
Okay. And you don't worry about the vitamin C sort of inactivating the ozone?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of that. And it's not that much. So I'm not using a super dose of vitamin C in this case.
Okay.
So it's not enough to turn it into hydrogen peroxide, which you can do at the high doses. So they're at lower doses. Yeah. And I've not seen any bad reactions. In fact, we'll often see it help.
Actually,
I mean, the Myers cocktail itself can be a lot for patients, especially the magnesium is just so warming and just kind of, especially with POTS and those kind of, you know, orthostatic issues, it can make you feel really dizzy or lightheaded and certainly warms your nether fields and you feel like you're peeing your pants when you get Myers cocktail, which can be a thing. So it's not for everybody and we don't always add it, but yeah, those are some of the tools that we have.
So where else should we go? What else are you doing? What else is exciting in your practice right now? You have two offices now, I believe, right?
We have two. Yeah, we're hoping to open a third next year just to better serve the Chicagoland area and make sure that everybody has better access to the IV therapies, for example. I mean, our practice is growing and it's, you know, by leaps and bounds. I have three PAs that work with me on the chronic complex side of things.
Okay.
But it's really cool because we also have one, soon to be two cardiologists. We also have a longevity and hormone team too, kind of looking more at that aspect. And it's really great because we get to work together really closely to help these patients. And I mean, hormones are a big thing these days. And obviously a lot of these Lyme patients need hormones too, but the Lyme patients are some of the hardest patients to get those hormones under control, because when the Lyme and, you know, mast cells and mold and things are not under control, those hormones are really hard to balance as part of that process. So it's always an interesting balancing act to get that all together, but it's really fun because we get to work together as a team.
So you use a team actually approach to some of what you're doing.
Yeah. So we get to use everybody's expertise in that sense. And sometimes it's just asking questions at rounds for that. And sometimes it's actually, we're all seeing the patient and kind of collaborate that way. Yeah. It's really great. It's a fun group to work with and get to help a lot of people, which is fun.
Yeah, which is so important. Listen, I think that there are just not enough physicians treating pediatric patients right now, you know, and the fact that you are and, you know, opening more offices and training others. I mean, you're teaching, you're lecturing and going on podcasts. You know, I think that that's really important because I think for a long time, you know, there were like a handful of doctors in the entire country that were willing to treat kids with these conditions.
Yeah.
What do the rest of the people do, you know, and they just suffer. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing more and more is that they're just, no matter where in the country, there really is this, I don't know if it's fear. I don't know if it's ego. I don't know where it comes from a lot of other doctors, but you know, they don't want to go there with their patients, the pediatricians. I don't know if it's a default, that position that they have, that kids are well. And so there's no way that kids cannot be well. And so then they blame it on the parents, or they blame it on, you know, anxiety, or they, you know, needs therapy. And that's so sad to me, right? That people are not taking this seriously. So, you know, I think we just need more providers treating kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have a large childhood population. We're lucky enough in Chicagoland, there are, you know, a small group of integrative, if you will, providers, but they're, you know, they're far out in the suburbs. There's not really a cluster of us. There's just a couple and we all kind of know each other and talk and, you know, share patients and support each other in that way as well. And one of my PAs, Tara, is becoming really well known for her pandas work. And, you know, it's really hard. Some of those treatments require things like IVIG, which is really hard to get covered by insurance.
Are you doing any of that yourself?
Not so much. Like, we get it covered at times. We're not really doing it in our office. They usually get done at infusion centers. But The coverage, it's so hard to get covered. It's so hard. We do have a law in Illinois called Charlie's Law, which can help a little bit to get it covered. But it's a tricky population. And these kids and these parents, they go through a lot. And the schools don't understand. And the schools don't want to help. And, you know, I had a patient today she misses school a lot. She gets sick. She has to miss school for a few days. She goes back. She gets sick again. She has to miss school for a few days. And, you know, we've got it under good control at this point, but she still misses school. And so the Children's Services is still like being notified when she's not at school because they don't trust her or her mom that she's sick, you know, and that there's a reason she's not at school. She's not just playing hooky. You know, so like there's that part is, I think, one of the hardest things, too, with kids and dealing with these populations is there's not enough understanding. You know, there's not enough acceptance. There's not enough credence and space given to these kids to heal. And then they're in these moldy school buildings. And that's another fight, right? Which just can, for some of these kids, they're so sensitive to these things. And, you know, it's this, you know, snowball effect. And it's tricky. It's hard. I said kids are resilient. I do think that there's a good chunk of them that do get better quick, which is lovely and nice. You know, I mean, I've been working with some patients for 7 years before we start to see like really, you know, good stuff. So it's nice when we have someone, okay, 3 months later, we're like, things are good. Like we're making improvements. It's not always true, but I do kind of see that on there, especially when we can get to it, when we can actually figure out what we are treating and treat the right thing, their body responds. Yeah. And then it starts to heal from that process. But none of it's easy. You know this. It's not any easier than adults. And often ways it's harder, like we mentioned before. But yeah, there's just not enough. There's not enough resources. I agree with you. And I feel so bad for these parents and these kids that they're not getting the support or the acknowledgement, you know?
There needs to be reform at the school level, but also about the mold, there's just so many issues that I see, and I don't even know where I would start. And I just hope there are people who are starting to look at this because it just is, it's not a good situation. Let's say the parents bring the kids in because the kids are having more, let's say, acute problem, sometimes not acute. I'm sure some of it is chronic too. It just takes them a while to figure out where they need to go. But how many of them have either siblings that are also then wind up under your care or the parents themselves? How often does that happen?
A lot. Yeah. A lot. I mean, I had a kiddo today who's a twin and her twin doesn't have these issues. So there's that. But I also have a family of eight. They all have something to various degrees, you know, and is it mom and dad passed it on? Or is it that they're all playing in the same backyard? Yeah. You know, but they all will present differently too. Like the mom with six kids who all present differently and have different treatment plans. God love her. Cause everybody's body is so different. So even if they do have the same bugs, they're going to present different ways. So they're going to need different treatments and different support along the way. Right. But it's really common. It is. It's really common. And I'll hear parents say, well, you're going to see the whole family because we got the sickest kid in. And we started to see improvements. So then the next one, you know, and then they bring in the rest of, and then mom and dad come in, right? And grandma and grandpa come in. So it starts to kind of bring the whole family. But that's a good thing about family medicine too, is that you do get that. You get to see that whole family, and that dynamic plays a role in all of this too.
Well, that's my favorite, really, to be able to take care of multiple generations. And I do have that, you know, families like that. But I see, the point being is that I see that too. I do think that I have families where I take care of actually like three generations. So it's grandmother, mother, and then kids. And the kids are already like in college, but they, you know, I took care of them when they were a little bit younger. And then, you know, what I see is that the grandmother is actually maybe the healthiest in some ways. In some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Still has chronic issues and getting older. I mean, there's lots of things, right? But it's a little bit different. But a little bit more resiliency, actually. Then the parents are not bad, but they have stuff. And they definitely have a lot of stuff. And you're still unraveling things. And, you know, they're older than their kids. So they have more traumas or they have more things they've had to deal with. This is my theory. But the kids are more severely afflicted on many levels.
Yeah.
And it's not that, like you said, kids can be easier to treat in some ways. Absolutely. But I think they have more challenges because they are exposed to more toxins. There's no other explanation.
No. Yep.
And it's epigenetic. They have more exposure to environmental toxins.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Pesticides, plastics, petrochemicals. I can go on and on and on. PFAS, whatever, right?
Yep.
But then it's also the phones and the EMFs and the social media. Sure. Right? So I just think that the kids are really in this position where it just breaks my heart that it does seem to be that the kids are even more vulnerable than ever.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I'm thinking more like little kids when I talk about it, you know, when you start to get into the teenage and 20 years age group. But I hear exactly what you're saying, and I agree. And I think that that toxin burden that we pass down generation to generation, you know, that bioaccumulation of it, then plus the fact that we have a more toxic world that we're living in, and then you throw, you know, pandemics and things on top of it, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
We're in trouble. This is an issue. I mean, there's 205 kids a day diagnosed with vector-borne infections.
Yeah, that's a crazy statistic.
And that's just, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because like you said, like all of these other issues, and it's harder to fight those infections when you have those toxins, when you have that stress, when you have the EMS, when you have all that stuff on there, piling it up.
That's right.
Yeah. But that's why it's important to for parents to be their advocate for their kids, you know, and say something is different, something is wrong. If we can get this now, it's less of an issue. Like, don't take this is all in their head. It's all psych. Don't take that for an answer. That might be part of it, but there is a reason. Look for it. Something is going on. And maybe it's just detox. Maybe it is just they need to be detoxed. Simple enough, right? I say it's simple, but we know it's not. Right? That's why, like, I listen to parents. I trust parents. When parents say something is different, I believe them. Something is different. Let's figure this out. Because the more we wait, the longer we wait, the harder it is.
That's very good advice. I was going to ask you, because we're going to be finishing up, you know, what's one piece of advice that you would give? And I mean, I think that was perfect. Couldn't have been better. So, I think it's the fact that they can have a relationship with you, and that, you know, that you trust what they're telling you, and they trust that you understand them. And, you know, that's not really very common, unfortunately, in our day and age. So, you know, so that's amazing. You're helping a lot of people. Okay, so how can people find you?
Where are we? We are on the interweb. So caseintegrativehealth.com. We also have a social media, Instagram, Facebook, that kind of stuff. It's all under Case Integrative Health, but I'm also on there on Instagram as Dr. Casey Kelly. We also have healwithcase.com, which is our online teaching tool. So we do have some courses on there. I have a course right now, The Fundamentals of Healing, a groundwork for healing, which is about how to eat well, detox, sleep better, move better, et cetera, to just kind of get some of those good solid foundations for healing. And I will have Alime Academy coming out soon to help give some online teaching and good, reliable, ready to use tools to help people kind of work through this, especially, you know, it takes a long time to get in to see Lyme doctors because we're so far and few between, to help give tools to get the party started and get things moving while you wait. I think it doesn't replace seeing a good provider, but I just wanted to get more tools out there for people to help more people in more ways. So check us out.
Yeah, great. Great stuff. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Yeah. So lovely to see you as always. I wish I could give you a big hug.
I know. Dr. Dempsey and Dr. Kelly, thank you so much. This has been some amazing information. I think a few of us are going to have nightmares tonight about those biofilms in the blood that you mentioned. But we are so grateful for your time and your expertise. Hey, listeners, that's all for now. So thank you for listening. May your mast cells be good to you. And please join us again soon.
As a reminder, anything you hear on this podcast is not medical advice. Consult your healthcare team about what's right for you. This show is a production of Standing Up to POTS, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. You can send us feedback or make a tax-deductible donation at www.standinguptopots.org. You can also engage with us on social media at the handle Standing Up to POTS. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing to our podcast and sharing it with your friends and family. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at www.thepotscast.com. Thanks for listening.